This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, beginning an oral history interview with Robert Rankin, U.S. Navy Reserve retired. Today's date is the 4th of May, 2004. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mike is joining me by telephone from the Washington, D.C. metro area. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Mike, can you start just by telling me a little bit about where you were born and when?
Yes, I was born on the 19th of January, 1937 in Lake Village, Arkansas.
Okay, and what about your folks? What did your dad do?
My dad owned a, or worked for first, and then owned a small clothing store. Mother was, I guess, a housewife is one way to put it. She did not have a specific business.
Did you work outside the home at any point?
No, she didn't.
Okay. And did you have any siblings, Mike?
I had one sister who died about 4 years ago, and I have one brother who's a physician in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Okay. Did your dad serve in the military at all?
No, he didn't. He said once, and I remember his saying it, I was too young for the first and too old for the second, meaning the First and Second World Wars. Dad was born in 1905.
Was there
so he was not in the military.
Was that a matter of regret to him at all?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I was actually the first to in the family to serve in combat. Of all my parents, grandparents, siblings, and all the rest of it, I was the first. So I don't remember his saying it with any kind of regret, no.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about where you went to school, particularly high school.
Lakeside High School. I'm about to go back for my 50th high school reunion into the month.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That'll be fun and interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I went to the University of Arkansas pre-med and then the University of Tennessee Medical School.
When did you graduate as an undergrad?
Undergrad in January of 59 from Fayetteville from the University of Arkansas. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Razorback.
There you go.
And I love sailing a Texan, that. And went to the University of Tennessee from 1960 and graduated in 63. Then did my postgraduate training in psychiatry after some of my initial Navy time.
And tell me about your decision to attend Tennessee. What informed that decision?
The reason I went there rather than the University of Arkansas was that you could go all year round and finish a couple months early. Arkansas made you lay out every summer. The University of Tennessee did not. Also, it had a reputation for being a better medical school. So I went there. What I did with that time I saved, I've never been sure, but but I did graduate there.
Now, did you have any ROTC experience?
I had ROTC, Army ROTC, at the University of Arkansas. We were required to do that. It was a land-grant college. They only had two ROTC programs, Army and Air Force. Boy, did I make the wrong decision. The Army had us marching around. I could take an M1 apart and put it together, blindfolded and all of that. The Air Force ROTC sat in classrooms and watched movies. And I thought, boy, I don't want to be in the Army. This is no fun.
How did that decision come about? Was it something that you were in charge of, or did you just...
You mean in the ROTC?
Yes.
I honestly don't know. I don't remember how I made that. Oh, I think I probably made the choice because I'm acrophobic and I don't like flying. I was afraid the Air Force would make me fly. I don't mind flying as a passenger. I didn't have the idea I would want to pilot a plane.
Sure.
And which is the same reason I didn't go into the flight training in the Navy, although I'd like to have been on a carrier. But I think it probably was I was afraid they would put me in planes.
Did you have medical school in mind from an early age?
Or? Oh yeah,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Where did that come from?
Probably from family. Mother's family. I come from a very interesting combination background. I consider myself an Irish Jew.
Okay.
Mother's family were Polish Jews, dad's family, Scots-Irish Presbyterians. Poland I had no interest in, but I loved Ireland. Judaism had a lot greater appeal to me than Presbyterianism, so I sort of combined the two.
Interesting.
And it was the Jewish family, mother's family, who really encouraged me to go to medical school. Dad and his family were pretty well happy with anything I might want to do in college. No one in our family had finished college before. Dad and mother both started, but dropped out for various reasons before they finished. So they were just happy. Dad was just happy I was going to college. Mother died when I was 7, so she had no influence directly on what I did professionally. But her sisters and brothers were all very strongly encouraging me to go to medical school, and so I did.
Did they live nearby?
They lived 70 miles away.
And did you see them a lot?
A lot, yeah. Mm-hmm. When my mother died, when my brother was born, she died in childbirth with my brother, mm-hmm. who continued to live with mother's family down in Louisiana for whatever reason. I wasn't party to the decision. They decided to let him stay with them for the time being. We already had my sister, who was only 2 years old when mother died. That dad was trying to raise both of us without a lot of help.
Right.
So I guess he figured an infant was a little more than he could handle.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother grew up down there, and we'd go down almost every other Sunday.
Really?
And spent a lot of time with him, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your brother then also went to medical school.
He did, yes. He went to Tennessee Med School, too.
Oh, okay. And was he a Razorback undergrad as well?
No, he went to Tulane undergrad, and he's a fiercely partisan LSU fan.
LSU. Huh?
Although he never went to LSU, he chose, I think, a team he thought was more likely to win.
Well, I was going to say, what about the Green Wave?
Well, he has no interest in the Green Wave whatsoever. My brother is a bit wacky. He has not missed listening to or going to an LSU game in 34 years.
Well, I have to say, LSU stole the football coach who got them the national championship from
Michigan State,
which is my undergrad.
What's your undergrad?
Michigan State.
Oh, Michigan State.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean.
MU.
That's right.
Right. I've got two very good friends who went to MU.
Is that right? It's a very good school. Good
yes,
for ag and a few other things, too, but a good school.
Right.
Mike, let me ask you about your medical internship.
Okay.
How was that arranged?
We had a choice. We applied for a number of internships. I had an aunt and uncle, mother's sister and brother-in-law, who lived in Chicago, and I really wanted to be in Chicago. I loved Chicago. From the time mother died, they used to send me up there in the summer to be with my aunt and uncle, and they became sort of surrogate parents to me, so I had maintained a strong tie to the city. So I applied for and accepted an internship in Chicago at Presbyterian St. Luke's.
Now, at some point here, the Berry Plan intruded, I think. Is
the Berry
right?
Plan was what guided my entrance into the Navy, yes.
And can you talk about how that came about? When did you first get contacted by the Navy?
Well, I didn't get contacted by the Navy. I contacted the Navy. I grew up in Lake Village, Arkansas, which is a lake, a town on a lake. I loved the water. I practically lived on the water in the summer. They had trouble getting me to Chicago because I so missed fishing and swimming and all the rest of it. They only got me up there because they promised there was an even bigger lake. I tried fishing in Lake Michigan, which didn't work out very well.
It's a different thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But I was water-oriented from the start. I loved the water, and I also loved travel, and I loved seeing the world and all of that. I had done very little of it. I mean, where I grew up, if anyone went to Memphis, everyone sort of viewed them with awe. But to me, going up to Chicago sort of let me know there was a bigger world outside of southeast Arkansas, and there might even be a bigger world outside of Chicago. So I was very interested in seeing all of that, very interested in being on the water. The draft board in Lake Village let me know in no uncertain terms. They let me go through internship, but after that, I was theirs. I had three choices, the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. I'd already had an Army experience in ROTC. I knew I didn't want that. The Air Force, I was still determined to put me in planes. I didn't want that.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy was going to put me on ships, was going to send me to exotic ports, was going to show me wonderful parts of the world I would never otherwise see. And so I went down to the Navy recruiter and joined.
And this was what year?
This was in 1963.
In the fall?
My internship ended in July of 64. So it would have been, I did this probably in the early spring of 64. Let's see, my internship was 63, 64. So I was doing this in early 64.
Okay.
And I remember going out after I had done it. I had signed up with the Navy, and they said, fine, you know, come July when you finish, we'll give you orders and get you trained and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up to Great Lakes,
yes.
to the Great Lakes Naval Reserve Navy Training Center up there, asking to see ships. I had never seen a Navy ship. I thought it would be fun to see one, and they didn't have any ships up there. But what I did notice was that when I came through the gate, they saluted me, and they said, sir, and I all felt really really nice,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, well, I'm going to enjoy this. So they toured me around, and then they said, you know, if you want to see ships, we have a few small ones down at Navy Pier in Chicago. You can go down and look at those, and I did. But I never really actually saw Navy ships until I got to Newport.
Which would have been?
Well, that would have been, what happened was they sent me to the U.S. Naval Academy in July,
mm-hmm.
Right after my internship, to have 3 weeks training with other newly minted young doctors to teach us to wear the uniform, to salute, to say bulkhead instead of wall, and, you know, all those sorts of Navy terms.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we all went out to the fleet. They had us trained for 3 weeks. They flew me from Newport, or from Annapolis, up to, I think it was someplace in New Jersey, and then my ship was in Naples that I was reporting aboard to. So they flew me to Rota, Spain, to wait for the ship to get into port. It looked like it was going to be in Naples for a while, so they, after a week in Spain where they had a sub base, they flew me over to Naples, and I joined the ship there and rode it back.
Did you get to do much in Spain besides be on the base?
No, I was only there a week, but it was wonderful. It was exotic, and I was running around looking for flamingo clubs and all of that. These people in the small town must have thought I was nuts. But I also got to Sevilla, and I got down to Gibraltar, and, you know, I made the best of the week.
Sure, absolutely.
And really got around to see as much as I could there. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a beautiful place. However, Franco was still in charge, and you really got a sense of the oppressive nature of that regime there. The Guardia Civilia were everywhere. We were warned not to say anything against the regime, just to be, you know, quiet about everything, and I thought, wow, this is different.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first time I had that kind of experience.
Did you make any other observations about that?
Only that this was the hottest and driest place I had ever been. And when they flew me to Naples, they flew me first up to Mildenhall Air Force Base in England, where they were delivering some sort of package. It was just a, you know, a few-hour stop. And as we flew over England, it was so lush and so green, and I remember thinking, this land, this isle, this blessed realm of kings, and what, you know, all this, all the Shakespeare stuff that I had learned in high school and college came back.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of fell in love with England from the air. And then they flew me on down to Naples, where I joined the ship.
Now, at some point, Mike, I'm sure you must have had an opportunity later on to get back to Britain.
Yeah, a couple times. Yeah, I never got it back up to Mildenhall, but I've been back a few times just as
going,
a tourist.
Going on your own?
Yes, and to Scotland, too, and to Ireland, which I just loved.
I was going to ask, did you ever make it over to the Emerald Isle?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I certainly did.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I went to school over there.
Oh, did you? Where?
Yeah. I went to London, University of London, for 7 years.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, and I got to travel around. So.
I love Galway. I love Dublin's great, but Galway's even nicer.
Right. Well, Cawkins is a good old Irish name, so.
Ah, okay.
From the south east.
Which county?
I can't remember the county, but the town's name is Clondalkin.
Okay.
And it's just a corruption of that.
Okay.
Yeah, just poor, very poor.
Well, Mayo, God help us.
But very, that's right. So I had some adjusting to do living in England, as you can imagine.
Oh, I'll bet.
I had a lot of Irish friends in London, though. Let me ask a little timeline question, Mike, if I can.
Sure.
Can you tell me what you remember about President Kennedy being assassinated?
I remember everything about it. Every single thing about it.
Where were you, Mike?
I can tell you the exact sequence of the weekend.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was in Press St. Luke's Hospital. For some reason, it must have been around lunch or shortly thereafter, because I remember being in the cafeteria and then stopping in the gift shop there to buy a candy bar or something and hearing the news over the radio that was piped into the cafeteria. And was just stunned, and then I went up to the ward where I was assigned. I was a rotating intern. I think I was on internal medicine or may have been neurology. But there was a woman there who was one of the McCormicks who had had a stroke about 4 years before, was totally, absolutely comatose, but had been lovingly cared for in that room. The family had probably given half the funding to build the hospital,
sure.
So that was not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But Mrs. McCormick had this splendid room with a separate room for her maid and all of that.
Wow.
And all the staff were gathered around in her room because she had a TV in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was really for the maid. It was for,
she
was totally unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And we all gathered around and watched that, and we were just stunned. And I remember that was a Friday, and I had a date that night with a woman. We were going to go to Second City, which was Elaine May and Mike Nichol were still there. It was just at the heyday of Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, do I cancel the date or not? And I thought, you know, this is not a night I particularly want to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her, and she agreed. So we decided to go to Second City, and, of course, they changed their whole format. It was not humor then. They were trying their best to, you know, to put it in perspective, and it was all just off the cuff, but it was kind of consoling. And then Saturday, I don't remember much about except watching television. Sunday, I went to Temple with my aunt. They had a Sunday memorial service, and when I came back to my other aunt's house, I remember her telling me that Oswald had been shot. And then, of course, during the during the funeral, we were all gathered around the television watching all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember that in great detail.
Mike, did it have an impact on you? Did it?
Yes, I was very fond of Kennedy. I remember he came through. Oh, I had a real. I almost got kicked out of medical school because of Kennedy.
Really?
You
Tell
know,
me
yeah.
that one. Tell me that
My
one.
My former wife and I, and two other members of our 36-member class, I think were the only four Democrats in the whole class. And the Republicans in the class and other medical school classes had a big booth in the student center for Nixon. So I went to the dean, and I said, I think that's a great thing. Would you mind if some of us put up something for Kennedy? And he said, I wouldn't mind at all. And then when you've done that, you can pack your bags and go home.
Really?
Because you will no longer be in this medical school. And I said, well, I think we probably shouldn't do that. And he said, you were quite perceptive, and you got the message in a hurry. So we didn't. But I remember his coming through Memphis and speaking down around the pier down there, down around the water, and there was a huge crowd, and I just thought he was great.
This would have been the fall of 60 then?
This was been in the, let's see, the election was November, so this was probably right after the inauguration, so it would have probably been September or October, yeah. I think that's the only time I actually saw him.
And what was your impression of him when you saw him?
Very bright. I was a Yellow Dog Democrat from the word go anyway, and he was very bright. I just thought he was great. He was introduced by the then mayor of Memphis, who was probably a little younger than he was, and Jewish, of all things, in Memphis. And I remember the mayor saying, now, there have been a lot of complaints about Senator Kennedy being too young and his religion and all that, and look who they asked to introduce him. Me, I'm younger than he is, and I'm Jewish. And so he made a humorous thing out of it, and Kennedy picked right up on that.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, this was the Bible Belt, and this was the very center of anti-Kennedy sentiment. I had been going occasionally to the big Baptist church there, Bellevue Baptist Church, with a classmate because I loved the music. The choir was just great. It wasn't a theological thing for me. I stopped going because about that time the minister got up in the pulpit and said, anyone who votes for John Kennedy is turning the country over to the Pope and will most certainly go to hell. And I remember thinking, Ben, I like your music and your choir, but I can't handle that. And he said, oh, he didn't really mean it. And I said, oh, yes, he did. So we hear echoes of that now, but I certainly remember that from those days.
Mm-hmm. Were you paying much attention to the movings of the civil rights activists?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when I would go home from on vacations, a lot of that was just beginning. And what I would do was I was working at the time with SLIC until they kicked me out. SLIC was the student, student nonviolent leadership conference.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It was an activist group of both black and white kids.
Now, is this at Arkansas or Tennessee?
No, this was they were based in Atlanta.
Okay.
And but they were, you know, I was giving money to them, and I was trying to help get involved a little bit with that. And what I would do and when I was there was to go over to Greenville, Mississippi, across from Lake Village, and they had a voter registration and a literacy project over there, and I would go over there and work with them when I was on vacation. And then SLIC became very, very anti-Semitic for some reason. I have no idea why. And I still have a letter from the leader of the thing thanking me for my service, but telling them from here on they could take it, they could do it on their own. Thank you very much.
Wow.
And
ouch.
It was, yeah, it was ouch. And then the other alternative was the Student Christian League or something that Martin Luther King was running, and I had the greatest respect for Martin, but I wasn't Christian, so that sort of let me out. So I just kind of did stuff on my own.
Did you ever hear Dr. King or any of
that? I did. I actually marched with him for about a day and a half at Selma.
You were at Selma?
Yeah, I took a leave. Well, see, Selma was a several-day thing.
Yes,
it wasn't
that's
just
right.
one march. They
yeah.
went from the bridge to Montgomery. And they stopped every night, and so I had a little time off. I took a little time off from the Navy leave, and I went down there and spent, I just did one day. I mean, I didn't do any big thing. I just thought they might need a doc. I took my little medical bag, and I think the best I did was treat somebody's sore feet or something. I didn't do anything, but yes, it was just an amazing experience.
And tell me a little bit more about the mood. Can you remember that? What was the feeling?
The feeling was one of absolute exhilaration and absolute terror. we had no idea. This was not too long after Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were killed. And I knew from my being so close to Mississippi and growing up near there just exactly what the mood was back there. This was dangerous stuff. And we didn't have any, we would not have been at all surprised if there had been snipers in the woods shooting at us. I mean, there was a lot of police protection, but clearly the National Guard from Alabama was not at all on our side. I mean, not the National Guard, but the Highway Patrol and sure. those people who were supposed to be guarding us were not at all on our side. I mean, we knew that. We didn't know whether we were more danger from people shooting at us from the Klan or from them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to put myself too much into this because I was only there one day.
Sure.
But, boy, the mood was amazing.
But, yeah, I mean, it's as many eyewitness accounts of that as can be entered into the historical record, as I'm sure you know, will be important in the future.
Right. Well, what was so moving to me as a Jew was seeing Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marching alongside with Dr. King carrying a Torah scroll. And, I mean, what a voice of, what a modern prophet. And it was very clear his message was, this is all based on the biblical injunctions towards justice, and I want to be here with you because this is my tradition, too. And, boy, I was just so proud of him, and, mm-hmm. you know, and poor guy, he really had problem walking. He was old at the time.
Yeah.
But, no, it was just amazing. I was not at the at the Lincoln Memorial when he gave his I Have a Dream speech. I wish I had been. I don't remember where I was at the time. But boy, that Selma march was amazing.
How many people were there when you were there?
Kept pouring in. I think I was there about the second day, and by the end of it, it had almost tripled in number. I would say probably 2,000 or 3,000.
Really?
Not quite sure, yeah. I know we had tents set up. We had an advanced group that went ahead
mm-hmm.
and set up the tents and had people all along the route who were providing water for us and all this stuff. And we had little medical things on the side,
mm-hmm.
too, little medical tents.
Were there press people around?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Taking pictures?
Yeah, there were.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, Mike, did you have any sense of there being people in the march who were there to observe rather than to participate?
No.
No sense of that?
I really didn't. I'm sure there may have been, but mm-hmm. It seemed to me that everybody was there for the same reason. We felt this was a defining moment. This was a time when we were really going to capture the nation's attention, and we wanted to do the best we could with it.
It must have been hard to leave.
Yeah, it was. It was. I only had a couple of days leave, and then I think I had rented a car in Montgomery, and I did rent a car in Montgomery. I remember the guy at the car rental thing saying, oh, you're in the military. You're not going to be going down there and hanging out with the niggers. And I said, well, actually, I am going to be going down there to join the march. And he was just stunned. He couldn't believe it that I was in the military and I was doing that. But it was, you know, kind of something I felt I needed to do and was glad I could do even just one day of it.
Did you march again at any point?
I've marched a lot of times on the Mall, but I think that was the one time for the African American Civil Rights Movement.
Okay. Returning to your naval work, your first duty assignment, as I understand, was on a destroyer. Is that right?
Well, actually, it was a destroyer division dock. I was DESDIV 102, which gave me four destroyers, but I mostly rode on the Lloyd Thomas.
Now, for someone who didn't understand that reference, could you explain what a 102 is?
Yeah, destroyer division number 102.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that was a group of destroyers?
Yeah, it was four destroyers.
Okay, and they were based where?
They were based in Newport, Rhode Island.
Okay, and...
You see, we hadn't had our orientation, our doctor's orientation at Newport, Rhode Island. We had it at the Naval Academy instead because, as our teacher told us, they're having the jazz and the folk festival up there now at this time during the summer when we have you here, and we don't want you up there hanging out with the communists and the marijuana smokers. So we got you down here.
Did someone actually say that?
Yes. And I really, you know, we were all, us young doctors, not quite sure whether he was kidding or not.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think I ever knew whether he was kidding or not. But that's what he said. And that's why he told us he said, we usually do it at Newport, but now they're having these folk festivals and jazz festivals up there, and there's marijuana smokers and communists and all that up there. So it was really kind of funny, and I was afraid they were going to find my Joan Baez and
uh-huh.
Bird albums and kick me out as a communist or something, but they never did.
Actually, on that topic, Mike, did you have to go through any kind of clearance procedures? at this stage? Or
yeah, it was very informal. Remember, this was before we really got into Vietnam, and
yes.
The McCarthy period was kind of over by
yes.
then. This was 63. I don't think there was much of the House Un-American Activity stuff going on then. So they just gave us a form, and it had about 50 organizations on there, and it said, are you now, or have you ever been a member of any of these organizations? And I don't think most of them I'd never even heard of. The fact was I never had been a member of any of these organizations, so
right.
that was
not
a problem.
You just
that was the screening.
Okay, so you just answered the question, and that was pretty much it?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long were you with 102?
1 year.
Okay. When did that duty assignment
end? That duty assignment started in July of 64 and ended in July of 65.
Okay. And during that early 1965 period, I'm sure that you were paying attention to the events in Vietnam.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me what you remember about that.
What I remember is that it was just starting up. I had been aware of Dien Bien Phu with the French and the French pulling out and all of that, but
mm-hmm.
really hadn't paid much attention after that to the agreement that ended all of that, where they were going to go a period and then have an election and unify the North and the South. I hadn't really paid that much attention to it in college. And now all of a sudden it seemed to be heating up, and I wasn't quite sure what that was all about. It certainly didn't seem to be anything that was going to affect me directly. I got married the 1st of August. They gave me a little leave after I left the ship toward the end of July in Newport. I had a little leave to go to get married,
mm-hmm.
and then was assigned to Destroyer Division 232, actually Destroyer Squadron 232. I had four more new ships. Met them in Long Beach. And next thing I knew, they said, we're going off to Hawaii to do some training, and then we're going to be off the coast of Vietnam. And I thought, well, wow, this is going to be interesting. And about that time is the time I think Johnson sent in the first large contingent.
Yes, it would have been.
That would have been July,
exactly,
I think.
Exactly that time, yeah.
Right, and that certainly got my attention. And I thought, wow, you know, something's going on over here. I better pay attention to this. Little did I know.
Yeah. What was your opinion of Johnson at that time?
Well, like so many people who'd idolized JFK, I was sorry that he was the president and so forth, but
mm-hmm.
I was beginning to turn around a lot because he got the Civil Rights Act through.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I was so impressed with that, and I thought, well, hey, this guy is really trying to move the Kennedy legacy forward, and that's a good thing. And so I was kind of neutral to positive about Johnson, I think.
Okay. And did you have any particular perspective on the commitment of U.S. forces over there?
No, I just thought it was probably a good thing. I was sort of thinking, well, you know, it looks like there's a communist insurgency here, and I don't think it would be good if the whole of Southeast Asia went communist, so I think this is probably a good thing. Let's go over there and see if we can help the South Vietnamese battle this. I certainly was aware of Korea. That was
sure, yeah.
Certainly something I knew very well about, and there were a lot of kids in my town who had gone to Korea. So I saw it as very much the same sort of thing.
Okay. And you said that the squadron was supposed to go to Hawaii first for training, didn't
we? We did. We went to Pearl, okay. Right.
How long were you there?
We were there about 2 weeks. And we were, you know, all we were doing was kind of sailing around, and I was really getting to know the ships and getting to know the men and making sure everybody was properly immunized and all of that,
mm-hmm.
Kind of enjoying Hawaii. I'd never been there before. I thought it was great. I tried to get my recently married wife to come over and spend some time with me there, but she was reluctant to fly and so didn't. But I was really just getting to know the ships. I had just been assigned to.
Was your wife a medical student, did you say that?
She had, let's see, when we married, she was in our med school class, yeah. She
uh-huh.
finished first in our class.
Wow.
And was a concert pianist before that, a real super achiever. And
sounds like it.
Terrific woman.
Very bright.
Yeah, yeah. And so let's see, when we married in August of 65, she had finished her internship and I think 2 years of her psychiatric residency.
Where was she staying then while you...
She was in Knoxville, Tennessee, where she was doing her training. Her parents were there, and so she was staying there while I was away.
Okay. Tell me about moving over to toward Vietnam. Do you remember that sale?
Yes, I do. I remember it very, very well. It seems to me, could this be right, that we sailed direct? We didn't stop at Midway. We didn't stop anywhere else. And we may have stopped in Japan, but what I remember most about that, I think we must have stopped in Japan. It would have been too far to go first. We probably stopped in Yokosuka. Mm-hmm. But I remember when we got into Vietnamese waters, it was late at night, or it may have been very early in the morning, and I used to like to hang out on the bridge with the sailors who were on the midwatch, because that was the time when a lot of them would come and talk to me about stuff they wouldn't talk to me about in sick bay that I knew they really needed to talk about.
I see.
I remember being up there, it may have been 1 or 2 in the morning, and it was when we entered Vietnam waters, and there came on on the 1MC, on the loudspeaker that went over the whole ship, mm-hmm. came on this recorded voice from somebody, it may have been the Secretary of Defense or whoever it was, mm-hmm. saying, gentlemen, you've now entered Vietnam waters. You are here to advance the cause of freedom, and you will be going into harm's way, and we want you to know the whole country is proud of you and all of this. I'm paraphrasing. I'm mm-hmm. not sure what the words were.
Sure.
But I do remember they made some very clear announcement when we entered Vietnam waters and when we were off, we were heading toward Yankee Station.
Did that seem odd to you?
No. You know, I was as gung-ho patriotic as anybody. I thought it was nice.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought that way. It seemed a little odd to me that it was at that time, but then I thought, well, they timed it according to when we get into Vietnam waters, so that
yeah.
made sense.
You mentioned that the guys would come and talk to you in the evenings or later at night
yeah, right.
outside of office hours.
Yeah.
What kinds of things did they bring to you at that time as opposed to clinical or sick calls?
Well, everything in the world.
Okay.
It would be, we would be standing up there having coffee, and I don't know whether you've ever been on a destroyer bridge or not.
I have not.
Okay, well, there are what we call the flying bridges, which is the little
yeah.
Sort of balcony off to the side on either side. And we'd go out there, and we'd just have our coffee and smokes and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they'd come out and talk, and, Doc, how you doing? How's that? How's everything going and all that? And, you know, how you doing, Charlie? Well, okay, you know, I've got this letter from my wife, and, you know, there's some problems with the kids. Man, you know, you think, Doc, she's seeing somebody else? You know, she hadn't been writing in a while. Those kinds of issues would come up. Doctor, I don't want to bother you in sick bay. I know you're really busy down there, but I seem to be having this bleeding, and I don't think it's anything serious, but, you know, can you give me a pill or something? And there would be times when I would just say to them, what time do you get off watch? Well, Doc, 2 a.m., okay, 1600, 0200, whatever. I'd say, okay, I tell you what, I'm not busy now. Let's go down and check it out. So I had sick call at 0200 or whenever they needed it. And that was some of the most effective work I did, I thought.
And
there were times they would tell me things they wouldn't tell the corpsman.
Yeah.
And there were also times they would tell the corpsman things they wouldn't tell me.
Probably.
So we had a nice working relationship.
Explain to me, if you will, the relationship between the corpsman and you as the MD or the senior medical officer.
The corpsman did initial sick day, and we had senior corpsman and junior corpsman, and I quickly checked them out as soon as I get on my shifts and see what they knew and how good they were and all that. My uh-huh. job was to take the problems they couldn't handle and to teach them to advance their knowledge and all that. Whereas that was technically what I was supposed to do. In
sure.
reality, they taught me an awful lot. I would learn an awful lot from them about the ship, about the various guys on the ship, various kinds of things that happened on ships, you know, what kind of acid-base problems you'd run into for some snipe who'd been working down in the boiler room and refused to come out, all those kinds of issues that I never got training on in medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a very good relationship. I never had a ship in my days on active duty when I didn't have a good relationship with the corpsman and an even better relationship with the corpsman in the Marines when I was in country. It's interesting. I have a little crazy thing I do. When I go to an event now where I'm in a formal Navy uniform with all my little medals, I wear one that's only allowed for enlisted men. And I wear that in honor of those kids that I served with over there, those corpsmen. And I always get asked by the officers, it's usually an all-officers thing, why are you wearing that? Were you enlisted before you were active? And I tell them that. I say, you know, if this were a formal Navy assignment, I couldn't do it, but I'm here at a party or here at a dinner or here at a Navy ball, and that's something I do for my own, because I want to do it. And I haven't heard one yet challenge me on it.
It sounds like this was a very respectful relationship in general.
It was, mutually respectful.
Mm-hmm.
It was. And we had a good time together, too. I mean, I would take them out when we get in port. I'd take them out to a dinner to a place they couldn't afford usually on their own. And we'd just have a all-medical department dinner. And I would get them, cut them loose. We'd do it early, and I'd cut them loose early enough to go out and play without the doc hanging out with them. So they had their own fun, too.
Were there particular guys Corman, that you remember, whose names you might like to mention?
Billy Warner, I think, was one of my favorite. He was one of the juniors on one of the ships. I really liked him a lot when we got back into port after I got back into Long Beach. He used to come over. My wife came and stayed with me then, and we used to have him and his friends over for dinner. And I got him to finish his pre-med stuff and got him into medical school.
Really?
Yeah, and he's a doc now.
Wonderful.
And
that's great.
Upstate New York. So he's one of the ones I had sort of paternal feeling about him, I think. And it was an interesting thing in view of what happened later. I wrote to my wife and I said, sometimes these kids tell me things on the bridge that are almost embarrassing, embarrassingly personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably having later recognized, although I didn't at the time that I was gay, there may have been some feelings I was having that I was having a little trouble handling there.
Mm-hmm.
But she wrote back and she said, please don't withdraw from them. What you're doing there is so important to them. And I thought, great. It made me, okay, that sounds right. And
yeah,
I think it was.
She sounds very smart.
Yeah,
very
she's
smart.
Very, very, very smart.
In different ways.
Yeah.
Very smart. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it sounds, Mike, as if you kind of grabbed onto that advice and thought, yeah, you know, actually I am doing something good
yes.
here.
Yes. It felt good to hear it, especially from someone I respected and cared as much about as I did her.
Yes.
And it was kind of reassuring that this is not in any way inappropriate, and just the opposite.
Yeah. What was the squadron's mission?
We had a number of missions. We went along with the cruisers and the battleships and all that to provide protection for them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, once we got off the shore, we did fire missions. Give you one example. We were off of Yankee Station, and an Australian base camp was under attack from an NVA and BC unit. And so we did fire support all around the perimeter of the camp and to try to drive away the attacking NVA and Viet Cong. And we were in constant radio communication with the Aussies. And so we did a lot of stuff like that.
Do you know where that camp was?
It was somewhere in between, it was somewhere near the High Van Pass. It was somewhere between Da Nang and Wei.
Okay.
Up on Highway 1.
Okay.
And yet that's so mountainous. That's the way I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I went back for my retirement party in Vietnam, when we all went back there, that we went up through there, and I found that a base camp, because I had been there too later. I may be confusing where I was with the Marines and where we were actually doing that fire support, but I think it's around that area. I do know it was north of Da Nang, and I think it was probably south of Wei.
So at some point, I'm thinking in the 1990s, you went back to Vietnam?
Yeah, when I retired.
What year was that?
From the Navy and from the VA, which was in late 96. A bunch of us went back and had my retirement party at the Caravelle Hotel, the bar at the top there.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you about that one later.
Oh, yeah. that was quite a trip, and it wasn't all good.
I'm sure.
A lot of the PTSD stuff came back.
A lot of mixed things going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you've described the mission and mentioned that fire support for on-ground troops, including Allied troops, was part of what you were doing.
Exactly.
Did you go ashore at any point and see the Aussies or work with them at all?
No, because when I was TAD'd over to up in I Corps,
yes.
I was strictly with American Marines,
okay.
Mostly with Force Recon, but strictly American Marines. I ran into the Aussies in Hong Kong and on R&R and
mm-hmm.
Yokosuka and all that,
okay.
And Kaohsiung, but never in country there.
Did you form an opinion about them and the support Australia was giving to the United States?
I loved them.
Yeah.
I really did.
Yeah.
I remember this fire support mission. We had a lot of fire support missions, but I remember this one so well because I can remember the voice of the man, the Aussie, who was coming on to telling us on the ship where to fire, and he was being attacked. Their whole unit was under attack, and he was being so calm about it and almost humorous about it. And I remember once he said, a little bit to the right, all you got was a buffalo over water buffalo over there. And fire a little to the right, please. And, you know, we were listening to this on the ship. We were all in general quarters. And I was in the wardroom, which was my general quarters station, because that's where we would have done all the surgical stuff if we'd had to.
Right.
And it's all being piped in all over the ship. And everybody's, you know, the kids are in the gun towers are firing and all of that. And we're listening to this running commentary from this Aussie saying, fire a little bit to the right, on the left there, all you hit was a water buffalo. And it was just amazing. I just had the greatest respect for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I found them to be wonderful, too.
Yeah.
And, did you go to Sydney on
I've never Arnold? Been south of the equator.
Oh, really?
Never have.
Oh, okay.
All those years in the Navy, I never went up.
There's something to put on your to-do.
Oh, it is. It definitely is. Yeah, definitely.
Mike, let me ask you about the first time that you had an opportunity to go ashore. What were the circumstances?
They were losing docks up there pretty quickly.
Up there meaning I-Corps?
Up in the I-Corps. And the captain just said to me, look, you know, we got good corpsmen on here. It's voluntary. Do you want to go or not? And I said, absolutely. Of course. Yes. And so they detached me over. I think they highlined me, if I remember correctly, to another ship. And the other ship, I think they highlined me to an LKA, and I went ashore in one of the boats there.
Mike, can I just stop
right there? But we went in. Just it was a little port somewhere between Da Nang and Hue, that we got ashore, and we had I know what it was. The LKA had Marines on it, and so they said we're going to highline you over to the LKA, and then we're going to send you ashore with the Marines, and we want you to stay over there, you know, a couple weeks. We're going to be just sailing up and down here, and you've got the corpsmen on here pretty well trained, so we can handle it just fine. If we need you back, we'll call you. And so I did, and that's how I got over with the Marines. I ended up staying about nearly 2 months.
Why did you volunteer?
Who knows? I mean, adventure. I was getting a little bored on the ship because everything was running so smoothly. Mm-hmm. Feeling the need to be supportive over there, the people who are really taking the flak and taking the heat and all of this. I guess it was all a mixture of a little bit of altruism, a little bit of sense of adventure. Who knows?
Okay. There would not, I take it, have been any kind of penalty, either formal or informal, for your declining?
No, nothing would have gone into my FITREP about that, I'm sure. And I remember the captain saying to me, you know, you don't have to do this. They put out an AHB, an all-hands bulletin, saying we need docks up here. Do you have any docks on your ships you can spare? And I remember when he was really nice about it. He made darn sure I didn't get embarrassed with the rest of the people on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
He called me into his stateroom.
Sure.
And he said, Doc, look at this. I've got this. And I don't want to force you or pressure you or anything else. They need docks over there. Do you want to go? And I said, Captain, I have confidence in the corpsmen on this ship and on the other ships in my squadron to handle things. And also, we were close enough to the other ships, like the Hope and the Mercy and all those, the hospital ships, that
yes.
If they needed to get somebody over there, they could. I said, if you think it's okay, it's not going to hurt the ship, I'd love to go. And he said, I was hoping you'd say that. And so he said, here's how we'll do it. And I remember one of the officers saying to me, well, Doc, what are you, nuts?
Mm-hmm.
But most of the rest said just the opposite. Hey, Doc, you know, I wish we could go with you and be careful out there and all the rest of it.
I'm sure they probably had a great deal of respect for that decision you made.
Well, yeah, I guess.
I'm sure they did.
I guess.
Mike, what was the ship's captain's name? Do you remember?
Sure. I've got this letter. Did you see my email about the letter?
Oh, yes, I did, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that later.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm looking at his letter right here now. He was the Captain Lee O'Brien, and here it is. George W. Ferris.
Is that F-E-R?
F-A-R-R-I-S.
Okay.
George W. Ferris.
Was he, to your mind, a good commander?
No, he was a superb commander. absolutely superb. The kids idolized him.
Really?
Just adored him. Can I tell you another story about him?
Please do, yeah.
Okay. We're coming out of the Sea of Japan. We're in the Sea of Japan. We have just come out of, we've had some ship repairs in Yokosuka in Japan, and we're coming out, and we're supposed to be hooking up with a bunch of other ships, probably 200, 300 miles out into the Sea of Japan. It's winter, it's rough. I'm not quite sure just what our assignment was, but anyway, it was important, and we were steaming for it. And a kid came down with what I thought was appendicitis on the ship. And I went to the captain, and I said, "Captain, this kid, I'm almost positive, has appendicitis. And the ship is rough, and I cannot safely operate on this kid on this ship." Thinking he would say, "Well, ice him down or do something or give him antibiotics or hold it because we've got this major, major assignment that we've got." He was on the bridge at the time. He didn't say any of that. He immediately turned to the officer who had the con, who was the guy who was setting the course, and said, "Make 180 degrees around." Immediately. We turned around. We steamed back in to port. And he, you know, he sent all the announcements that he needed to his commanding officer, saying why we were leaving. Mm-hmm. Got back in, got the kid detached off, got him into the hospital there at Yokosuka, and then we, 2 days late, got to where we were supposed to go. Everybody on the ship knew he had done that. I mean, he didn't argue with me, he didn't negotiate with me. He just heard from me that this kid was in trouble, and that was his primary concern.
That's pretty.
And so you can see why they got last.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mike, let's take a break.